After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
Hey, folks. Welcome back to The Greenhouse. We are joined by a very special guest, someone who I can only call a legend in independent podcasting. Some would say he's the hardest working man in the left podcast sphere. He runs a excellent podcast called Program to Chill. I've referenced it a couple times on the show. So I'm very pleased to welcome Jimmy Fallon Gong here to The Greenhouse. Jimmy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. That's very flattering. Thanks. Thank you for your kind words.
So we've got a lot of ground to cover here on this topic. I know people are looking at the title like Sus Michigan, what's that? But basically what we do here on The Greenhouse is, in addition to maybe unpacking some of the things about American political discourse that obscure how things really work or kind of blind people to what's really going on, is also to talk about certain historical realities or certain frameworks that help remove that obscuring effect. And that's something that I really appreciated about your work on Program to Chill, where you've, and this is, Program to Chill, I'd say, was like my real introduction to parapolitics, I guess Mind Games, the podcast as well. But I was hoping that maybe before we get into some of this material, we could maybe talk about parapolitics as a lens and some of what you do on Program to Chill for my audience, and maybe, you know, soften up the topic before we get to Michigan being a sus location.
Oh, yeah. No, that's very well said. So I should say up front, like, first of all, I don't consider any of the work like I do on my show to be like a substitute for like educating, agitating, and organizing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, parapolitics in general is not a substitute for politics. I think that's important to note. And in particular, like with my show, I'm not necessarily advocating like or advancing like a political project per se. My show, right, is about having fun with friends and learning shit, right? But I wish I could remember which of my listeners once compared parapolitics to vitamins in terms of like one's ideology. Because like, if a person's ideology is like a diet, right? Adi, we're not exactly receiving a good ideological diet here in the US of A, are we?
No, as Zizek would say, it is directly from the trash can, so...
Yeah. We're getting a lot of, like, hyper-palatable trash foods from the trash can of ideology, right?
Pretty
not
much.
Not a lot to actually feed you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, parapolitics isn't necessarily something that you can or should live off of. Like, maybe it's almost like a workout supplement. You shouldn't live off of that. But it can be sort of like a supplement to a good political education, you know? Like, you take something like, just pulling something out of my ass, like a People's History of the United States, something pretty good. And then you basically take that and you extend the analysis further to include the, like, the real-world implications of the fact that we have not one, not two, but 18 different U.S. intelligence agencies, which are doing things. They're not just sitting around doing nothing. And so we take basically that framework and extend it and see where that path takes us. And, like, some of parapolitics, or at least what ends up getting called that, is basically just history. Like, maybe you apply, like, maybe a class-based framework to the past, but it doesn't have to be that. You could also take just, like, a feminist framework, Black studies, Indian studies. Like, you can take these different perspectives that have real legitimate, like, viewpoints, right? You could call it social justice, but people don't like, some people think that term sucks or whatever, but, like, I'm not saying we concede the term social justice, but, like, basically, parapolitics can be extending that framework, but then add some of the spice of like, yeah, they maintain control of society using spies, organized crime, occult shit. Anything is fair game when it comes to maintaining control over society.
I think that's a good summation. We're basically in very typical greenhouse gaslighting fashion where my outline is already jumbled, so it's time to just stab at this a little randomly. So to follow up that question, to follow up that statement directly, right? This is a topic of discussion that came up on a previous episode that I'd like to pick your brain on. Basically, the premise was that there's a need to resort to parapolitics or conspiracy theory in America because of our adherence to norms or an inability to correctly identify power. Whereas in other countries, the example here was like India, for example, you can speak to connections, collusion, scandal, etc. more freely because there's less of an ideological or bourgeois distortion that you mentioned. What's your take on that statement or idea?
Yeah, so I'm not sure when my episode comes out, but I basically have some guests on who are Latinos, right? Mm-hmm. And one of them does make the joke like, yeah, parapolitics is just history in Latin America, right? Mm-hmm. And you're right, like, I can't necessarily speak from firsthand experience here, but like, I do have family members who are from other countries for whom this does seem to be the case. Like, I'll say something that, you know, would be controversial in the U.S. context, but they will just be like, yeah, that is kind of like, yeah, so basically, like, I take your point, like, some of this is just normal doing history, and when you're outside of, like, the hegemonic, like, structure in the U.S., like, it's easier to, like, at least listen to, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, maybe I should be asking you that question, like, how have you seen that to, you know, be at play?
I mean, that was going to feed directly into my next question. I think,
because I do have more to say, so I can just keep talking if you want.
I mean, I'll answer your question. You can keep going that. Where basically it's like, I mean, like in the Indian context, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
If a politician has like a known criminal charge against them, that charge will, one, get brought up as like a opposition against them in an election. Similarly, you'll also have their supporters, you know, come up and be like, and it's good that he did that, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
And I think in the United States, I don't know if this has necessarily always been the case, but this has been my read of it, especially in like liberal or more so academic circles where it's seen as very impolite at best mm-hmm. to bring that up. And at worst, it's like, what the fuck are you doing? You can't talk like that, you know?
Yes. Now, I think that the U.S. is becoming closer to maybe every other country where supporters will be like, it's good that they committed that crime. And then, like, detractors will be like, yeah, they're X, Y, or Z type of criminal, you know? Like, I think that, like, that veneer of respectability is dropping, which... you could argue that that's bad in some ways, but in other ways, it's like, well, that's just, you're seeing reality a little bit more clearly. I'm not entirely sure, you know, myself, how to feel about it. I can just see that it's happening.
I share that observation, and it's like, again, it's one of those things where it's like, I doubt if it's always been the case or if it's a recent mm-hmm. pattern, but it hasn't occurred in a vacuum, so to speak.
Yeah, because, like, if you look at, like, older politics from even, like, before the Cold War, that people were constantly calling each other, like, criminals. Like,
mobbed up or something, yeah.
This might be partially Cold War plus end of history hand-wringing that, like, isn't the norm, you know? And maybe we're just going back to, like, how it normally is. I don't know.
I think that observation is probably worth examining, and I think you're onto something there, because as we're going to get into with some of our extended discussions, that period of like probably like post-World War II, Cold War era stuff is the political environment we've inherited. That's something I've talked about on my show before. And I think the end of history is this like, it's almost like the end of history is NAFTA for politics, if you think about it that way, where it's like this ideological deluge that changes the game, basically.
Yeah. And like everyone from that era, and like we're both, I think, you know, younger, so like we kind of like got some of it, but we're seeing it fall away. But like people from that era like talk like idiots. Like
it's almost like they're irradiated, you know what I mean? Like yeah. We were on the younger end, so we didn't just get radiation poisoning by it, so maybe it wore off. But that generation is very ideologically scarred by it.
Yes. It's very strange. I do know one anecdote, right? And I think that like this was making the rounds on Twitter, and maybe people will remember it better than I'm relaying it, but like did you see that thing, Audi, where it's like a survey of people in the US across various ages and demographics, and it turned out that like basically just college educated white people thought that there was no conspiracy to kill JFK. And every other group of people basically were like, yeah, there was like a conspiracy, you know, leaving it open-ended as to like the nature of it. And like, to me, that kind of speaks to like a certain, like this exact thing, you know, like what is going on here with this like hegemonic ideology? You know, I'm not up on like cool terms for what to call this, right? But like false consciousness, maybe. Like it's almost like they view it as dangerous to engage with certain ideas or topics for fear of like contamination or something. And for my money, because you know that's not what I'm about, right? But like it's probably like a deep-seated anxiety, because I cannot imagine that some of these people don't actually know in the back of their minds. Because like, okay, in the case of liberals specifically,
yeah,
a lot of them will concede to some sort of statement that the U.S. is like a country that has a problem with white supremacy, right? How could you possibly believe that's true, but then think that like the U.S. government is telling the truth about the Oklahoma City bombing or 9/11 or JFK or take your pick? Like, how can you hold those views and be like, yeah, they're oppressing like what, like 40% of the population, but like they're definitely telling the truth about these deep events.
That
just doesn't make any sense.
You're onto something there. I think not to bring up Matt Chrisman from Chapo again, but like he brought this up in one of his streams, and he called like the modern university as this kind of like ideological car wash. I use the term, although I don't know if he uses it in any specific context, but specifically in the context of the American Academy as it stands today, when I say liberals, what I really mean, I guess, is like, and I've talked about this on my program before, is this concept of American civil religion. I don't know if you've encountered this in your work. But to me, it's been a very effective and reliable framework to explain this ideological radiation that pervades our discourse and modern political thought in America, so to speak, where basically like there is this pantheon of historical figures, this idea that the religious the political institutions have these real traditions that need to be respected and are righteous or fair fundamentally in some way, and that if anything isn't fair, you know, it's a individual misstep by a bad actor and not by design, so to speak. And I think that, you know, to be a liberal in the American context in this day and age is to be an adherent of that faith, so to speak, right? I think if you adopt a more materialist or Marxist framework, you kind of see it all for what it is, And you can dismiss this as like, well, you know, America is this bourgeois settler colonial project. Its institutions exist to protect bourgeois rule. And you see that in domestic and foreign policy, and especially in parapolitics and all the covert stuff that goes on, right? But that's yeah. that's been my framework at looking at this, is like, if in an ideological sense, right? And I'm not saying that, you know, everything I learned at university was useless, or that
right.
you know, everyone who goes to a public university does this, but it's more like going to the seminary of this religious institution, and then to question it is apostasy, so to speak.
Well, yeah, because we also all learn how to not get fired by saying something gauche. Like, that's like half of what college is. But I did like what Matt Chrisman said, that it's like a car wash, because it's a cash-based business, and B, it's engaged in money laundering. So it's like that in a couple more ways as well. No, that's good, though.
Yeah, and I guess to that point, right, I guess for people who are beginners to this topic, or maybe just might not have the familiarity with it, parapolitics and conspiracy theory as terms, like, what's the difference between the two, or is there even one that matters?
So, basically, I mean, my personal understanding is that, like, parapolitics pertains to, like, a field of study, which really is several topics, which are basically underserved by traditional fields of study. Like, mm-hmm. which field of study studies intelligence agencies? I don't think there's one with a formal name, you know? Like, who studies organized crime? Who studies the intersection they're in? So, like, parapolitics is probably a useful term to describe this sort of, like, interdisciplinary field that tries to grapple with how these things interact with each other. And, like, in, like, a better world, it probably wouldn't really be, like, something other than just, like, conventional history if our institutions weren't so captured and steered away from those lines of inquiry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then your question was, like, how is it different from, like, how is parapolitics different from conspiracy theory?
Yeah, and maybe I'll supplement that question, too, with, like, when did the term conspiracy theory get so covered in flies, basically? I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, because, like, conspiracy theory, I think, in most people's, well, I guess there's kind of, like, two meanings, right? But, like, in the narrow sense, it, you know, pertains to, like, a specific theory about what might have happened to any given deep political event. So, like, deep events, I think, are a term from Peter Dale Scott, who was, like, diplomat, poet, and academic. Deep event would be something like 9/11 or the JFK assassination, or, you know, lots of, like, minor events, too. And, like, although it's probably, like, old hat among, like, my listeners, maybe, I do think that, like, it's probably not well known among, like, normal people that, like, the CIA basically took the term conspiracy theory and they intentionally made it into a pejorative in the wake of the JFK assassination. Like, there are memos where they talk about doing that. So, like, I don't personally have a problem with the term conspiracy theory, but for sure, it is now in 2023, it's something you say when you want to delegitimize something someone is saying. But, like, the fact of the matter is that conspiracy is a legal term. People are constantly prosecuted for conspiracies. People are constantly committing conspiracies and getting away with them. The fact of the matter is that some of this pertains to people's just sheer inability to grapple with the fact that, like I said, we have 18 different intelligence agencies, we have many organized crime groups, we have private intelligence firms, you know, there are just, like, weirdos out there doing things on their own. Like, people are constantly doing weird conspiracies all the time. On top of that, in every city and town across America, Canada, I mean, the world, really, there's always an old boys network of civic power engaged in conspiracies to maintain and increase their own control. Lord knows the cops are usually in on it, And they have their own little conspiracies that they're covering up. There are class-based conspiracies, the capital B bourgeoisie. They're always trying to maintain their power and wealth. And then capitalism itself, yes, is basically always conspiring to make more money. Now, Adi, it's funny, right? I know, I'm not starting beef. I did get into it with a big podcast on the left, which shall remain unnamed. And we were arguing that capitalism, well, this person was arguing that capitalism is structural, which I agree, and that therefore there simply don't need to be smoke-filled back rooms where they are conspiring against us. But the fact of the matter is that there are smoke-filled back rooms where they are conspiring against us. Those exist. There's no reason to ignore them or not talk about them because, you know, if any one of them, maybe you, like you think that this, there's this one smoke-filled back room where they like plotted some horrible thing. If you're wrong about that, well, it doesn't matter because in every single case, like there are, like they're always doing this. Like, let me ask you this. I know this is kind of in your wheelhouse. Okay, like the oil companies, they conspired to cover up evidence of global warming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Banks conspire together to like redline black communities. Like, it takes organization to pull that off. It wasn't just a structural decision. Like, it is structural, but there were people, like real people, who sat there and said, this is how we're going to increase our return on investment, by basically like stealing wealth from this community. I mean, they maybe didn't phrase it that way, but a lot of times they actually fucking do. So like, my argument with this podcast, which shall not be mentioned, was that they were saying capitalism is structural, so we shouldn't emphasize conspiracy in our work of educating people about capitalism. And like, okay, I disagree like militantly, because my point is that workers don't want to hear abstract theories about money turning into commodities and that those commodities turning back into money, MCM, CMC. Like, at first, workers don't want to hear theory. Workers want to hear, often in great detail, about who is fucking them over and why. Who's conspiring against them? What crimes are they guilty of? What are other things that they've done that they're not even aware of? Like, I'm not saying theory is not important, but theory is not what you use to agitate and orient the masses, right? And like, my argument is rooted in like my family's own experiences. Like, my grandfather was an auto worker not far from your neck of the woods back in the day. The union wasn't always there. They had to fight for it. And you know what? Like, most people are like that. They, like, my grandpa didn't join a union because, like, someone said, capitalism is structural and we need, like, you know, countervailing institutions. No, it was like, Henry Ford is a fucking psychopath and they're fucking you over. Like, that's what gets people to, like, you know, join a union or something. And basically, people learn through fighting. And you won't get people to fight unless you get them angry. And yes, they're already angry, but like, if you say, be angry at those people who are fucking you over, like, that's what you're supposed to do. So like, you get them to fight for their immediate interests, and after that, you get them to fight in solidarity for other people too. But like, putting your head in the sand and calling capitalism structural and that therefore we shouldn't talk about conspiracy, that's just not going to cut it. Like,
I think that's spot on, yeah. Because like, structures are maintained by people at the end of the day. And as we'll go into in one of our topics, one of the slogans at these UAW strikes was literally unionism, not Fordism. It's in the slogan that we're against.
Exactly. So like, to paraphrase Utah Phillips, right? The workers' movement, and you can substitute other things. The workers' movement is not dying, it is being killed. And those who are killing it have names and addresses.
There's the quote.
And like, to a certain extent, parapolitics and conspiracy theory, however, whichever one, both, is trying to identify who's responsible for these crimes. And ideally, that will be useful to actual organizers. that's basically my two cents.
I think that's spot on, and I think you did address a lot of those questions with that one answer. I've got a couple more with this initial interview, so this is a question that calls back to your episode in The Crying of Lot 49, namely what you describe in Pynchon's work as a tactical retreat into the past. Do you want to elaborate on this tactical retreat into the past as a way to correct certain myopic tendencies today?
Absolutely, I do. So, correct me if I'm wrong, right? But I was kind of into the whole Bernie Sanders campaign.
Whom among us?
Whomst among us, right? I imagine you were pretty in the same boat. And, like, in the wake of those failed campaigns, right, there was a lot of talk as to, like, why did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
And in these talks, you know, there was a lot of, you know, like, demobilization, deinstitutionalization going on.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people turned that those negative feelings inward. And side note, also, it's pretty funny because, like, it's not just Bernie Sanders fans that did this. Like, you probably saw, like, when Hillary lost, a lot of people were like, we failed her. And it's like, no, man, like, don't internalize those feelings. Come on. It was not your fault.
It is not your fault they forgot to campaign in the Midwest. Trust me. Trust me.
But, like, so basically, at any juncture you want, this always happens. Like, whether it was, like, 68 or, like, other junctures in history where, you know, there was this rising movement and then it just gets crushed. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's always various groups trying to make different arguments for different things, right? And, like, I know my buddy George also described basically going through a similar process. The fallout from the Bernie thing, I guess you could say. And, like, for me, I turned to parapolitics, basically. Because, like, I really, like, I was pretty down on it, but, like, you basically, I didn't create the shadow app to fuck Bernie over during the Iowa caucus. Like, mm-hmm. I don't run a mafia-operated ballot box company to tally votes. Like, you know, like, we didn't do this, so it's not our fault. But seeing why things failed is just, like, good politics for the first thing, right? But, like, on the flip side, I know it can be really, like, a balancing act because there is that risk of demoralization in learning all of the many, many ways they maintain control and crush any movement they want. But in the initial, you know, period where you're learning about this stuff, there is a certain relief in knowing it wasn't your fault, not you specifically, and not even really most people in a broad sense most of the time, for why a given good thing didn't happen. But in terms of, like, a tactical retreat into the past, like, I do have a tangible example of this, and I'd like to tell a brief story, if I may.
Go ahead.
Okay, so my perception, Audie, is that I'm a little bit older than you, but do you remember Occupy Wall Street?
I lived in India at this time, but I'm broadly familiar with the broadest strokes of the event.
Gotcha, right. I don't need to, you know, explain what Occupy Wall Street was to your listeners, though, probably, right?
Probably not, no.
Okay, cool. So, first of all, I want to say, this is just a funny side note, I actually went to Occupy Wall Street Provo, Utah, which was the world's most cartoonish, dumbest fucking version of Occupy that existed. And I'll throw this gauntlet down. In the entire world, it was probably the worst version of it. It was literally, like, in an empty lot across from literally just a local regional Wells Fargo bank. Total clown shit. One day I should, like, do a write-up on it, but, like, either way. So to tell this story, basically, years ago I read this book, Jeffrey Sachs, The Strange Case of Dr. Shock and Mr. Aid, by an author named Jaffe Wilson. And the book was put out by Verso Press. And for all the shit I give Verso Press, I do like a lot of their books.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the whole book is basically a biography of Jeffrey Sachs, which is actually fitting because he was born in Oak Park, Michigan. But the TLDR and what's relevant for this story is that Jeffrey Sachs is basically an economic hitman. He was one of the top economists in the country. His big claim to fame was that he advised various countries, getting them to enact either neoliberal globalizing policies, you know, this is in the 90s, or in the case of Poland and the dying Soviet Union and, you know, Russia, helping them enact shock therapy to absolutely, like, devastating results. So it's beyond the scope. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that. Yeah, I think Naomi Klein touches on some of this in her book, The Shock Doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He plays a major role. So it's beyond the scope of this episode, right? But what happened in the Eastern Bloc in the 90s was a crime against humanity, right? I'll pull a mind games card here and say that I cannot say what I would like to do to Jeffrey Sachs. Then, to save his brand, Jeffrey Sachs pivoted to being a foreign aid economist. So he rebranded as like a humanitarian. Even that is problematic, but like, needless to say, the book unpacks those claims as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just a bad guy. Okay. So the year is 2011, September. Occupy Wall Street. We're talking the big one in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Zuccotti Park. The protests are going on for weeks. And after a certain point, you know, after the initial couple weeks of craziness, different public intellectuals start showing up. So like Cornel West shows up, for example, several other people. But then guess who shows up? That's right. Jeffrey Sachs.
Huh.
So Jeffrey Sachs tries to become a spokesman for Occupy Wall Street, because there's famously no spokesman. You know, that was one of the major critiques of the movement, was that it could be steered left or right, and, you know, no one was really at the helm.
Mm-hmm.
So Sachs was trying to steer it away from revolutionary anti-capitalism into a more populist attack on corruption specifically.
Mm.
And this is, like, very well documented. He actually has a book that he wrote called The Price of Civilization, where he literally writes the line, "No class war is needed or intended."
Interesting. Very interesting.
So for people who think that class war is needed and intended, you know, this would be pretty bad. So Sachs would go to Zuccotti Park at least three times, and he would speak to them. I think all of them are basically online somewhere. And I don't know if you recall, but they used to do this thing because they didn't have microphones, so they would use a thing called the people's mic. So it would basically be the speaker shouts as loud as he can, and then everyone in the crowd would just, like, repeat, like, what the speaker said. And it's kind of interesting in terms of, like, potentially, like, certain social tech, like, getting people to almost, like, chant things. But, like, that aside, so Sachs would speak, and he would get people to say these things. And he got the potentially insurrectionary masses to chant the following things. Globalization was good for many poor countries. The purpose of government is to raise productivity. We're not against markets. We're not even against banks. And we need a law of markets. So what put a stop to this? Well, for all of the crap that I give Trotskyites, it was a group of Trotskyites from the Trotskyite Internationalist group who saw Jeffrey Sachs there speaking, and they confronted him loudly and publicly. One of them was an academic familiar with Sachs's work in Bolivia specifically, and asked him, like shouting at him, like directly, and asked him about the shock treatment that Bolivia had to go through, and shouted, like, "This man is a criminal enemy of the working class. He brought incalculable misery to working people. So this pretty much got Jeffrey Sachs to run away, and he didn't go back to Occupy Wall Street. And like, you know, for like, yes, you could call this just politics instead of parapolitics, but like, I would argue that more often than not, at least in our tiny clicks on Twitter or whatever, like, it ends up being people into parapolitics who remember who these evil fuckers are.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I read that book years ago, and I was inspired by those plucky trots who simply knew who these ghouls were, because they're constantly trying to infiltrate and divert the left. And, like, for me, that was an aspirational story. I wanted to know who these fuckers were. And, like, if studying history is basically, like, a tactical retreat to, like, make sense of the current moment, at least you can be ready the next time a Jeffrey Sachs shows up to try to speak for everybody, you know?
Yeah, you basically destroyed my question with that anecdote. Wow. Needs no further contradiction from me. So I got one final softball and we can head into talking about Michigan. So This is a slight throwaway. You've spoken earnestly about your enthusiasm for podcasting as a medium. What specifically do you think it offers to creators in our sphere, as well as its potential as a medium?
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the biggest benefits is one of the biggest drawbacks, which is that there's, like, virtually no barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a wonderful, beautiful thing. But on the flip side, you know, that means that, like, it's hard to, like, set your show apart from just the deluge of, like, other shows trying to, like, do similar things. But, like, there really is just, like, this crazy amount of freedom, like, that you have in the podcasting medium. And, like, I don't know. Like, I think it's funny to make fun of podcasting because it is funny and it's a joke. But, like, on the flip side, it's, like, a bizarrely intimate medium, actually, if you think about it. Because, like, You know, a lot of people have talked about the whole parasocial thing. But, like, you really do feel like you know some people that you listen, you know, for whom you listen to their podcasts. And, like, you, like, it's not to say that you just, you know, end up taking whatever view the person talking is saying, but, like, you, like, for me, you know, I often listen to podcasts when I'm, like, doing dishes or, like, doing chores or something.
I'm here, yeah.
But, like, those are moments when often you're alone and you're just thinking about things. And, like, so, like, it really can connect with people at, like, a level that is just, like, almost astounding, you know? And, like, yeah. It's, like, wrong to just, like, only make fun of that possibility. Like, in fact, it is, like, actually something that, like, you should, like, take seriously and, like, make sure that, like, you are, at least as a content creator, like, taking seriously to, like, not just, like, make the world worse, but to maybe try to make the world better. And, like, that doesn't mean to be, like, moralizing or whatever, but, like, you know, like, you know, I don't know, you know what I'm saying?
I get 100% what you're saying, and I appreciate the perspective, right? Because that's a similar situation I'm in with my podcast listening. Like, I know for our particular Twitter clique, like, most people got suckered into shows like Chapo, if not, like, Street Fight Radio and, like, that cohort of podcasts, right? And specifically, like, this is a separate topic. I didn't know, like, I've always wanted to talk to someone about this, so I guess, like, this is the perfect time to do it.
Let's do
it. Is, like, yeah, like, my intro to Chapo, of all things, was, like, when I was living in New Orleans. I was there alone. All my friends are back up here in Michigan. And basically, I'm just listening to podcasts to, like, fill the emptiness, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, like, people get, like, very attached to the medium and the podcast they listen to in a way you just don't, even with shit like YouTube or Twitch, where you can see someone's face, right? this is also why I was saying that, like, I felt starstruck talking to you, because yeah, we do interact on like online plenty enough, but you know, you've only ever been talking at me, so to speak, as a listener, and now like to be in a dialogue with someone you've been listening to in that sort of intimate way you described, it is jarring. And like the parasocial element in podcasts is, it's the oddest of any online medium, so to speak. It's like being a fly on the wall, but also being invited to be the fly on the wall, so to speak.
Yeah, like I used to listen to, of all things, right, the Trillbillies, which I still love the Trillbillies. Like, you know, I might have changed my mind on a few podcasts over the years, but like, not the
incredibly entertaining. Incredibly entertaining, of course.
Yeah, and like I used to listen to them through like some of the worst times in my life, right, where I just felt so alone, you know, through various reasons that, you know, are neither here nor there. But like, they were, you know, it felt like they were there for me. And like, I know they didn't know me at that time. And then like, at a certain point, you know, I had them on my show and vice versa. And it's bizarre because like, it feels like I knew them already, but they didn't really know me at all. But like, either way, I mean, I think that's another thing too. I think over time, with a prolonged exposure, like, you do kind of see, like, often, yeah, you're seeing people's best side, but like over time, you see enough of it or hear enough of it to like pick up on good and bad traits too. So like, I don't think that it's entirely like fake, you know what I'm saying? Like, you are seeing like a character that people are basically doing, but like, you will pick up on the good and the bad, is what I would say.
Yeah, yeah. It's a level of familiarity where it's like, you're, I don't know, like the pitch that gets a lot of people into podcasting or makes people think about starting one is this idea of like, hey, we have these deep conversations where we talk about this very, you know, niche or intellectual stuff. Let's record it, put it on the internet. And then this feeling of being watched can either be something you get paralyzed by or something you learn to live with or something you learn to ignore. But I don't know. It's like with all content creation, there's a degree of like your independence with it and you feeling like you're doing something good with your work. And then there's also just like the panopticon you can't separate from it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much the case anymore, but there was a point at which, like, if I posted on Twitter that I was watching a movie, people would be like, oh, you're doing an episode on that movie. And it's like, no, I just watch movies. Like, most things aren't going to be an episode, you know?
Yeah. So, thanks again for putting up with my questions. Let's get into what I really called you here for. This was part one of our Sus Michigan episode featuring Jimmy Fallon Gong. Jimmy runs a great podcast called Program to Chill that I encourage you to check out. I'll have links to the show in the description below, as well as links to our social media as well. Thanks for tuning in, dear listener. Take care.